Welcome to this podcast documentary from Nutmeg Magazine. I'm Daniel Gray, and this is From Blitzkrieg to the Bernabeu, the Basque refugee children who became footballers. In October 1936, it was announced that an international football match was to take place at Ibrox, the home of Rangers. It would see Scotland play Germany. The proposed fixture became a focus for anti-fascist activity. One local, William MacDonald, caught the pre-match mood when he wrote to the Daily Worker newspaper, "The Nazis have violated every law and rule of sportsmanship and decency, and yet they have the insolence to send a team of propagandists onto Glasgow, a socialist city noted for its love of freedom and democracy. There will be no football at Ibrox on that particular day. In the interests of peace and safety, the magistrates of Glasgow should urge an entire veto of the match. In this, they will have the loyal support of all lovers of peace and fair play. The Scottish people want no truck with the representatives of Hitler and von Papen. Our slogan and that of the trade unions should be, no truck with the Nazi murderers. If an impudent attempt is made to proceed with the match, I can visualise in Glasgow the mightiest protest demonstration of our time." Yet the match did take place on October 14th. Scotland won 2-0 with both goals scored by Celtic Jimmy Delaney. Anti-Nazi protesters were arrested and the swastika flew over the main entrance of Ibrox. Many Glasgow anti-fascist protesters would go on to volunteer in the Spanish Civil War, which had begun in July of that year, 1936. The conflict pitted the forces of a democratically elected Republican government and their volunteer soldiers from all over the world, the International Brigades, against General Franco's nationalist coalition, supported militarily by Hitler's Germany and Mussolini's Italy. When Scottish volunteers reached Spain, football would feature again with matches between different battalions of the International Brigades. There was a particular rivalry between the British and the Canadians of the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion. In a letter home, Scottish Brigadier John Golan wrote that the Brits had challenged the Canadians to a contest in the ancient and honourable traditional game of football as played in Britain. The happy noises a game of football conjures contrasted with a distant soundtrack of artillery fire. Coats and jumpers were used for goalposts, and there were 18 men on each team. In a cup upset, Canada won 5-4. The British put their defeat down to the Canadian Spanish guest players. "Ringers" was the familiar cry. Of the 549 Scotsmen who volunteered to serve in Spain, many were, naturally, football fans. Some years ago, in an archive, I was perusing a list. It contained brigaders' names and addresses and their repatriation dates or details of the day they were killed and in which battle. So many desperate ends reduced to a few numbers and figures in Spartan typewriter ink. The addresses were always interesting. It was possible to see patterns and rarities. A large number of volunteers from certain areas of Glasgow, friends from the same neighbourhood in Aberdeen, a sole volunteer from the Isle of Arran. One name and address is a few streets from where I live now in Edinburgh, J. Russell, 18 Edina Place. On the tenement entrance door of that address, the old Russell nameplate is still in place. It amazes me to think from these ordinary, battered doors they walked off one day to Spain. At the end of the main list were a few names, those brigaders' outcomes at that point unknown. My eyes fixed on one Andrew Foley. He'd given his address as the Hibernian FC Supporters Club on Easter Road. That club still thrives today, the home of grim pre-match predictions of defeat and exultant post-match Elvis tribute nights and all the rest. I've never been able to find out anything more about Andrew Foley. Did he work at the Hib Supporters Club, a caretaker, perhaps? Or did he sleep on the floor there? Or was he there more than he was in his real home? But when thinking about football and the Spanish Civil War, there is one story that piques my interest and tugs on my heartstrings more than any other. The tale of the six Basque refugee children who became footballers across the border in England. This is a yarn of defying odds, of spinning miracles from misery. It is an example of how football can lift humans out of despair and into an altogether more splendid kind of life. In October 1938, the great Spanish Republican leader La Pasionaria described international brigadas as examples of the universality of democracy. The Basque refugee children who went on to be footballers represent the universality of football, an internationalist game for an internationalist cause.
There's a valley in Spain called Tarama. It's a place that we all know so well. It was there where we gave up our manhood, where so many of our brave comrades fell.
By the early spring of 1937, Spain's Basque country was, perhaps, the fascist leader General Franco's deepest irritation. Stubborn, resistant and strong, it threatened the fascist vision of one authoritarian Spain. It was a furious boil that could only be lanced with the most vicious of scalpels. The fascists summoned the barbaric possibilities of German and Italian help. Hitler's Condor Legion and Mussolini's Legionary Air Force were laden with bombs and a terrible kind of curiosity that asked, how could war best be waged? How could a town be pulped, a people's spirits shattered? This area in the north of Spain would provide a vast training ground, target practice. So it was that the fascists advanced on the Basque country, aided by their German and Italian amigos. What happened next was a heinously brutal chapter in a war full of them. For the first time, civilian targets were bombed from above. Blitzkrieg was trialled. Modern methods of atrocity were born. Total war had become Europe's dark, foreseeable future. Moulded was the pattern for World War II and so many other conflicts afterwards. It all began with an air attack on the town of Durango on March 31st. Opening bombs struck a church at mass time, a strange target, given how the fascists boasted that God was on their side. More than 250 locals were killed that night. Then, on April 26, Guernica. The statistics and timeline read like an impeachment served on 20th century inhumanity. Up to 1,600 people killed in under 3.5 hours of bombing. The human horrors behind the numbers should still now make for angry tears. Pablo Picasso's greatest work must be looked fully in the eye. Those horrors involve the lost and the ways in which they died and the left behind. And what they saw. In all of this, of course, children, or those that survived, had to carry on. They had to find their joy, kick stones among ruins, play hide and seek in the rubble. Our six footballers were among them. Most came from Durango and Guernica. The war-torn Basque country was, though, no place for children. It wasn't really a place for adults either, yet they had no choice but to stay and resist Franco for as long as was possible and then face bloody repercussions. In May 1937, an evacuation programme for Basque children began. 33,000 kids were shipped off to Belgium, Denmark, the USSR and Switzerland. At first, British Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin held tight to a policy of non-intervention in Spain's war maintained since its outbreak. No children would be taken. And, in his words, the climate wouldn't suit them. But public pressure could not be ignored. Though no government aid would be given, a ship carrying 4,000 children would be permitted into Britain and each allowed to stay for 3 months. Most stayed for longer. Some made their homes here. The ship carrying them to the UK was a cruise liner, the Habana, adapted to carry 10 times its normal capacity of 400. On May 20th, 1937, the Habana was docked at Bilbao, preparing to set sail for Southampton. It's a harrowing scene to try and imagine. Parents planting fervent kisses on their children's cheeks and foreheads, as if to leave implants. Constricting hugs powered by love and a longing already creeping in. A dark thought that this could be the last time parents saw child. For that child, confusion, desperation, hurt, perhaps even some excitement. No one really understood where they were going. Britain was left to the imagination. Clasping a few belongings wrapped in paper and tied with string, each child queued to climb aboard the Habana. Every girl and boy had an identification number written on a tag worn around their neck, and one can only imagine what it sounded like. More harrowing noises for the kids who'd heard Guernica happen. Wailing parents, bawling children, grandmothers ranting demonically upwards at God. Then an almighty foghorn shaking the earth, shaking everything they thought they knew, shaking families apart. The Habana moved off, children waving white handkerchiefs from its balconies. It would be accompanied for some of the way by a fleet of Basque fishing boats, protection against scudding by German submarines. That's how bad things were. Imagine those parents, watching the boat slide away with their hearts on board. Imagine those children, watching their parents rooted still as this vast beast carried them off. Among them were Emilio Aldecoa, Sabino Barinaga, José Bilbao, Antonio Gallego, José Gallego, and Raimundo Pérez Lezama. Each one of these boys would grow into a professional footballer. The crossing to Southampton was rough. Children were thrown around like twigs in a hurricane. On May 23rd, they arrived there to a splendid, heartfelt welcome from locals and those from elsewhere who'd been part of a magnificent fundraising campaign for the Basque children. All children were given a medical, fed and put into a camp consisting of hundreds of bright white tents. Football soon erupted. Balls scrounged from somewhere and dribbled among guy ropes and campfires. Then the children were dispersed to homes or colonies across Britain. As there was to be no state aid for the refugee kids, everything provided would have to come from charity, fundraising, donations, appeals, events. Everything ran on goodwill too. Churches, wealthy people and educational establishments gave up entire houses that were hastily converted into Basque children's homes. Basque children also raised money for themselves. They performed dance routines and organised football matches. It was in these matches that some of our six first showed their remarkable talents. Which brings us to one such boy, Emilio Aldecoa. Emilio was 14 years old when he boarded the Habana, one of the older refugees. From Southampton, he was sent to live in a Basque colony in Stafford. His interest in football blossomed into love, and Emilio developed his tricky, wily left foot, not least in those fundraising games. Being old enough, instead of returning to Spain in 1938 or 39 when so many did, he decided to stay in England, despite the end of war in Spain and its beginning in Britain. Emilio took a job with English Electric and began playing for the Works football team. His skill was obvious. He stood out. Wolverhampton Wanderers offered him a trial. This was wartime football, meaning that the normal league structure had been suspended and regional fixtures organised in its place, all of them to take place in daylight on Saturdays. Guest players were needed, but few were more exotic than Emilio. In 1943, he made his first team debut against Crewe Alexandra. It made him the very first Spaniard to play a professional match in England. What a moment for a teenager who'd seen and heard things that no one should, a migrant who'd sailed into the unknown. That 1943-44 season, Emilio was Wolves' top scorer. He was a dazzling footballer, full of vim and verve. A dark and handsome lad among thick-set footballers who wore black eyes as badges of honour, those who saw Emilio play never forgot. Here was a technicolour footballer in a black and white world. In 1945, Emilio moved on to Coventry City, scoring against Portsmouth on his Sky Blues debut. He married a local girl and stayed for two seasons. For a while, another Basque refugee Habana kid played alongside Emilio. By some strange fate or mere coincidence, José Bilbao wound up at Rickety Highfield Road. Jose was an outside left, meaning that for his 6 Coventry games, he played immediately next to inside left Emilio. Such an unlikely pairing, so far from home. 2 young Basque men in the blue and white of Coventry City tearing down the wing in their long shorts if the wind didn't catch them before a defender did. City's attack proved that it was the best constituted for a long time, said one match report in a local newspaper. The all-Spanish left wing was a happy partnership. Walking around Coventry must have been a chilling reminder of what they'd left behind almost a decade before. The city, after all, had, like their Basque homeland, been pummeled by German planes, its cathedral violently sacked. Yet both had played football just as it was being reborn after the horror of war. A footballing boom was on the way, one tenet of quietly emerging optimism in the country. It's hard to think of a more intriguing time for the Basques to have been plying their beloved trade in Middle England. Jose Bilbao slipped from view like many wartime footballers. We don't even know if he stayed or went home. Emilio Aldecoa returned to Spain and played for Athletic Bilbao, Valladolid and Barcelona. At the Camp Nou, he was good enough to star alongside that Hungarian genius, Laszlo Kubala. The two were also the best of friends. What a thing to think that the great Kubala knew tales of the Habana and Stafford, of Molyneux and Highfield Road. Perhaps Emilio's greatest achievement came after his playing career. A dedicated, precise and sagacious student of the game, he compiled a lengthy blueprint document for youth development and scouting, setting out how Barcelona could become the greatest club in the world. Though his work was never officially recognised, so much of the ideas contained therein can be seen in what became Barca's La Masia system. Emilio was not finished with England and from 1960 undertook a coaching and scouting role at Birmingham City, implementing systems for finding and developing players way ahead of their time. What a journey from the Habana to Highfield Road, from misery to La Masia and beyond. Before Emilio Aldecoa and Jose Bilbao had begun their professional careers, 2 Basque refugee boys had used England as a starting point for theirs. Both would become greats of the Spanish game. Sabino Barinaga and Raimundo Perez Lezama were also among the 4,000 on the Habana. Sabino was leaving behind the debris of the bombed town of Durango, while Raimundo came from Baracaldo, just outside Bilbao. At the time of the sailing, Sabino was 14 and Raimundo 16. By some cosmic bending of the future, these 2 young people that would become Spanish football stars were housed together. Neither was forced to leave Southampton, a place of fond memories for young Basques after the welcome they'd received. The 2 teenagers were instead given lodgings in Nazareth House, a city orphanage run by nuns. Outside, in the safety of this refuge's gardens, both began to play football in every spare moment they had. Raimundo went further, studying textbooks about the game and its rules in his bunk bed. That adoration of football was again blossoming for young Basques in England. Their enthusiasm was matched by ability. It seems that both-footed forward Sabino was the first to be spotted by a local Southampton scout. He then quickly impressed Saints first team manager Tom Parker, a man who knew talent when he saw it, having played nearly 300 times for Herbert Chapman's Arsenal. Sabino, said Parker, is one of the most brilliant youngsters I've ever seen. Goalkeeper Raimundo was soon scouted too, or possibly concurrently. One telling of the story goes that the two were spotted kicking a ball around in the car park outside the Dell, Southampton's dear old home. Both soon began playing for the Southampton youth team. In 1938-39, their performances in the local youth leagues were astonishing, even if at a level clearly already beneath them. The team played 33 games, winning 31, scoring 277 goals and conceding just 17. In the 13 games he played in, Sabino scored 62 times. Raimundo was eventually to play 3 games for the Southampton first team. When another season in English football came around, a move upwards surely beckoned. Southampton wanted to make them first team players, but their Home Office licences to remain were not extended. Besides, Britain was now at war where peace, albeit buttressed by violence and suppression, existed in Franco's Spain. The two travelled home in March 1940. In 3 years, they'd grown into young men, fought the psychological traumas of fascist invasion, and become two of the most promising footballers in Europe. Back in Spain, they pursued what family they had left. Being Basque in Franco's Spain was difficult enough. Being Basque and probably the sons of dreaded communists was even worse. Maybe it was football that spared them from the repression suffered by so many thousands of others. Spain needed players. It needed to rebuild its teams and league. Despite an offer to stay in Bilbao and play for Athletic, Sabino understandably took the greater offer of Real Madrid money. Seeing the poverty of his family must have made that a simple decision. Raimundo signed at first for a lesser Basque side, Erinaz, but after 3 months was spotted and scooped up by Athletic. He was to stay for 16 years. Raimundo's playing style made him both a marvel and a novelty. Where goalkeepers had hitherto bowled the ball out or kicked without much thought, he saw throwouts and kicks as opportunities to form attacks. Raimundo played way off his line too and was comfortable on the ball, the sweeper-keeper of his day. With Athletic Bilbao, the bunkbed boy of Nazareth House won 2 La Ligas and 6 cup medals. Sabino, meanwhile, set Madrid alight. The strapping Basque scored 4 goals in an 11-1 mauling of Barcelona in 1943. Then in 1947, he became the first man to score at the brand new Bernabeu Stadium. Perhaps, in quiet moments, he allowed himself a bittersweet grin. The son of a Basque communist, now the hero of what some regarded as Franco's team. Raimundo and Sabino's paths crossed regularly in league fixtures, but in 1943, the Nazareth boys clashed in the Spanish Cup final. Athletic Bilbao defeated Real Madrid 1-0. Some said that Raimundo Lezama won the match. While Raimundo was a one-club man, Sabino played for Real Sociedad and Real Betis after the Bernabeu. He then became a manager, holding the reins at more than a dozen club and international sides in Spain and across the world. Sabino was manager of the Valencia side that, in 1966, travelled to Elland Road and found themselves in an on-pitch battle with Jack Charlton et al. He died in 1988, aged 66, while Raimundo lived on until 2007, passing away aged 84. While at times the relationship between Sabino and Raimundo could appear to be that of adopted brothers, our last two Habana refugee footballers were blood brothers. Antonio and José Gallego came from Errenteria in the far northeast of the Basque region. In April 1937, their father had been killed at Guernica. Defying the heartbreak it would bring, the boy's mother insisted they board the Habana with their 3 sisters for safety in England. 12-year-old Antonio, 14-year-old Jose, and their sisters were given beds at first in Eastleigh and then Cambridge. They stayed in a home for 30 Basque children owned by Jesus College, Cambridge. Soon, like Sabino and Raimundo on the lawns of Nazareth House, and like Emilio Aldecoa with his fundraising games, the Gallego brothers set up football teams and matches. Then in his late 80s, in 2012, Antonio told the El País newspaper, "Football was all we thought about. As long as we had football, we were happy. It meant everything to us. It was the only thing we knew about. We got attached to Cambridge and made a lot of friends there through playing football. If it hadn't been for football, we would have lived a very different life." Though never scaling the heights of Sabino, Raimondo or Emilio, both Gallegos had talent in abundance. They may have daydreamed that had they gone home to Spain like those three, their careers could have taken off. But England, and particularly Cambridge, had become home to the Gallegos. In the mid-1940s, Jose, a left-winger, and Antonio, a goalkeeper, were signed up by local non-league side, Cambridge Town. Scouts flocked to see the exotic Basque boys in this most unlikely of settings. Jose was signed by Brentford, and Antonio by Norwich City. Things did not work out for Antonio, and he was freed in 1947, returning to Cambridge Town. Jose played 6 times for the Griffins before a 1948 move to that home-from-home for Basques, Southampton. Though he strived, there was little first-team opportunity for Jose at the Dell, but he was, in one of those delicious footballing footnotes, the young player charged with cleaning Alf Ramsey's boots. In the one game he did play, against Barnsley, a loutish tackle cracked his ankle. Jose drifted on to Colchester United and then back to Cambridge United, that city now, it seemed, firmly home. Football, while clearly a second heartbeat for the Gallegos, must often have faded into the background as the 5 siblings wondered what had happened to their mum. That year of 1947 marked a decade since they'd last seen her at the harbour in Bilbao as the Habana set sail. Then a breakthrough. Mother and beloved children were reunited after the Red Cross helped her locate them. Soon, she too settled in Cambridge. A family reunited 10 years after those vile bombs had fallen on their homelands. The Gallego brothers, meanwhile, played football into their 50s. The game was under their skin. Antonio married, started a family, and stayed here for the rest of his days until he died in 2015. What a thing this story is. 6 young people from the jaws of hell arriving into a welcoming Britain in which people defied their cowardly government to open their arms and rooms. All 6 were united by the misery they'd left behind and the miracles they became. They played football at levels high and low, but each one of them had this much in common. They loved this daft old sport of ours, this universal, magical game. Ninguno más que